Well, today is a special show. We're sitting down with one of the most prominent voices against the authoritarian pandemic response and the corrupted interests of running our supposed health sector. He's an attorney with a long record of going up against big money interests, first fighting for our environment, then the health of children through his organization, Children's Health Defense. And recently, he's been fighting against the greed of Big Pharma and for the civil liberties of us all. He embodies, in my opinion, everything I grew up believing his last name stands for, fighting for the people. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kim, and thanks for everything that you've done to wake people up about what's happening in this country.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, it's been quite the last few years, hasn't it? I know you and I have been in very similar boats of, and anybody who's been speaking up against the pandemic, speaking up against the lockdowns or the mandates, you know, we've been going up against, it feels like, massive waves of the ocean. I want to ask you, how has that been for you personally first, before we kind of get into, I want to do an autopsy of the pandemic now that we're 3 years in and it seems to be winding down to a degree. But for you personally, reflecting on all of this, I'm sure this has cost you greatly personally in a lot of ways.
Well, it has. It's cost me, I mean, like all of us, it's cost me a lot of friendships, at least during the pandemic. It's cost me, you know, 40 years of political contacts that I had, particularly within the Democratic Party, but even, you know, my friendships with leading Republicans. And then it's cost me a lot of income and business relationships and credibility. And of course, the press is now kind of impervious to anything that I would say and any argument in favor of these positions. But in terms of my personal life, people say to me, well, aren't you making a big sacrifice, you know, to advocate for this issue? And I don't look at it that way. I look at it as a gift. I was raised in a milieu and a family where we assumed that our lives would be consumed in some great controversy and that it would be a privilege if we were able to take some meaningful role in that. So I don't, you know, I love all the new relationships that I've made along the way. There are people who I disagree with on many other issues, but the wonderful thing about it is they're able to speak about those disagreements and have conversations. And you know, there's so much courage in the people who have said, who it's kind of an unusual group of people because it's something kept their minds open when all of the propaganda and the instrumentalities of, you know, of control and the institutional structures were trying to close minds and make people obedient. And there's this kind of 33% of the country that from the beginning was saying, we don't buy it, you know, and they're all different kinds of people, the Republicans, Democrats, blacks, whites, a Christian, Muslim, Jewish, they just come from across the board. But something unique about those people made them skeptical, made them immune to these attempts to disable their capacity for critical thinking, and then ultimately made them courageous, where they're saying, you know, I'm not going to go along with this. And, you know, it's been wonderful sort of meeting a group of people that, you know, that are essentially, you know, heroic in so many ways.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting few years, just kind of making these interesting political alliances, these, you know, strange bedfellows, right? All of us together. I mean, I grew up in a family that was from Idaho, Democrats in Idaho, and Catholic Democrats in Idaho, so they were obviously big Kennedy fans. On my mom's side, you know, they're refugees from Vietnam, and they were all, they're all Republicans. And so it's, you know, that, but interestingly, many on both sides of even them in my family agreed, you know, that the pandemic had driven people crazy, that people were going overboard. My aunt was out there protesting down in Orange County, the lockdowns and the mandates. And You know, so there was a lot of resistance, and I wonder what it is that actually made people that way. And some, you know, and I'm sure you've thought about it. What is it about those 30%? You know, is it that maybe we lack emotion, you know, and so we didn't get as afraid?
You know what, there was a, during the 1950s and 1960s and early 70s, the CIA did a lot of experiments with universities, with almost 200 universities around the country with social scientists to study human behavior. And they were experimenting with all kinds of things, with psychiatric drugs, with psychedelic drugs, LSD, et cetera, with torture, with sensory deprivation, and then all kinds of means for controlling not only individuals, but entire populations with propaganda, fear, all these things. So you had all of these universities getting hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars from the CIA or from CIA front groups for programs that were called MK Ultra. The reason it's called MK is that that was the code for mind control. So MK Dietrich, MK Ultra, MK Naomi, Operation Artichoke, Operation Bluebird, many, many others. We're all about funneling money to these universities to study controlling human behavior. And one of the famous studies was called the Milgram Experiment. And Stanley Milgram, who was a Yale associate professor and who was associated with the MK Ultra program, took people from every walk of life, students, professors, business people, blacks, whites, et cetera, and he would put them in a room with a man dressed as a doctor. And and they would be seated at a table with a dial in front of them. And the dial, they were told, was hooked up to a subject in the next room who, when they twisted that dial, that subject would get an electric shock. And the subject in the next room, they could hear him screaming and pleading and begging and struggling. And the higher they turned it up, the more screaming there was. And all of the people who were involved in the experiment at one time or another begged the doctor not to make him turn it up. But he kept telling them, turn it higher, turn it higher, turn it higher. 67% of them turned it to 250 watts where it was marked potentially fatal. So they were violating their own values because a authority figure was telling them to do it. That order, that kind of respect for authority, got them to override their most fundamental values, compassion and kindness and mercy, etc. 33% of the people got up and walked out and said, I'm not going to do it. And I think that 33% that that we're seeing now are the people who, you know, that group in the population that may be from a whole range of political backgrounds and parties who just has that, you know, maintains that capacity for critical thinking and is not subject to being, to that override from authority. And it seems to me, you know, it has struck me many, many times in the last year that we're all now in the grips of this huge Milgram experiment, where we have a doctor, Anthony Fauci, who is this trusted authority, who's telling us to do things that we know are wrong, like censor speech, like close all the churches in the country for a year with no scientific evidence, no citation, no public hearings, no public debate, who's ordering us to put on masks, even though he admitted a week before that masks don't work, who's ordering us to close every business in the country, 3.3 million businesses with no due process, no just compensation, violation again of the Constitution, who's telling us to get rid of jury trials, the Sixth and Seventh Amendment, when it comes to injuries by companies that are, you know, providing these countermeasures like vaccine companies, no matter how negligent they are, no matter how reckless they are, no matter how grievous your injury, you can't sue them. And here's what the Seventh Amendment says. It says, no American shall be deprived of the right to a trial before a jury of his peers in cases or controversies exceeding $25 in value. So very simple. There is no pandemic exception. And by the way, there were numerous, the framers of the Constitution knew all about epidemics. There were two epidemics during the Revolutionary War, a malaria epidemic that disabled the armies of Virginia, a smallpox epidemic that literally froze the Army of New England while it was conquering Canada. They had already entered Montreal. And Canada, without that epidemic, would be part of the United States today. So, and then between the end of the Revolution and the signing of the Constitution, there were epidemics in every city that killed tens of thousands of people, yellow fever, cholera, smallpox, and many others. So the framers knew all about it, but they didn't put an epidemic or pandemic exception in the United States Constitution. It's a new thing. You know, we had a civil war and Lincoln at a time when our country was really, you know, this far away from being destroyed. 669,000 Americans died. It's like, you know, 20 million people died today. And yet when he tried to get rid of habeas corpus, the Supreme Court said, you can't do that. There's no exception for war. There's no exception for, of course, there's no exception for pandemics. We had a Spanish flu pandemic in 1918 that killed 50 million people. And yet we did not stop the Constitution from functioning. So, you know, this was a new thing. It made no sense when you looked at the science, but a certain number of people were susceptible to just saying, okay, we're going to do what we're told. People, when they're scared, fear is a really potent motivator. It's a potent instrument of totalitarian control. That's why Franklin Roosevelt, in his inaugural address, said made this famous statement that is, you know, was the mantra until the pandemic of the Democratic Party, which is the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. This is long before the war started. What he was saying is, you know, there's an economic depression now. And the nations in Europe are abandoning democracy. A third of the people in our country thought that democracy and capitalism had failed and that we needed to go to another system. And in, you know, in Germany, in Spain, in Italy, they moved to totalitarian fascism from democracy. Germany was the most democratic country in the world. In Russia, they moved to communism. You know, all of them went to their own brands of totalitarianism because they were disillusioned with democracy and the capacity for democracy and capitalism to actually function. And Roosevelt did something different. He calmed the fears in this country. And he said, we're not going to be scared. That is the enemy. The fear is the enemy because it allows totalitarian systems to take control of people and destroy democracy and destroy institutions and values. And he said, we're not going to do that. We're going to methodically restore faith in Wall Street so that people take the money out of their mattresses, put it back in the banks and start investing again. We're going to respect democracy. We're going to create jobs for people. We're going to heal the symptoms and we're going to deal with it as a country. And we're going to do it in a way that respects the Constitution and our rights. And we're not going to allow anybody to take those things away from us. And unfortunately, the Democratic Party has lost a lot of that memory. You know, all of that experience has gone into this memory hole. And we're living in a situation now that, you know, I grew up reading George Orwell and Robert Heinlein and Aldous Huxley, and they're all writing these science fiction stories, these wonderful science fiction novels that were kind of warnings about, you know, a totalitarian system that would overwhelm democracy. So we all kind of had an idea that sometime in the great, great future, in the great distant future, that this would happen to our country, but I don't think any of us realized how close it was.
Yeah, I think many of us were very shocked by that. And I want to dig a little bit deeper into the psychology of this, because my fear in going forward is that, you know, we've seen a lot of these lawsuits that have been filed to end mandates. And a lot of times we've seen those lawsuits victorious. The people are told, okay, you can't have this, you know, this mandate must end. You can't force these people into vaccination. But the problem is that when I dissect these lawsuits, they're not ruled on the merits that we would like them to be ruled on, right? We would love the judges to say these vaccines are not real vaccines. They don't actually stop the spread. They're dangerous for certain people. You can't mandate them. Or to say to us something like, this is authoritarian. But that's not what they're doing. They're instead saying, okay, well, you're not the right body for the authority of making this decision, or you didn't make everybody do it. You only made some people do it. So it's arbitrary and capricious. It's not something, you know, so we're going to do away with it. And my fear is that that mixed with this pandemic response and how there were 30% of us that said, we're not doing this. They've learned the psychology. They've learned the loopholes that when they want to do this again the next time, they know better how to do it. It's almost like we didn't really win the battle we thought we won. I mean, here we are. Yes, mandates are ending. They're ending this massive vaccination program, kind of saying, okay, we're moving on. But I'm afraid thinking we actually lost in the long run. They now know how to manipulate us better. They learned through the pandemic, 30% of us just weren't scared enough. And so next time, maybe what they'll do is they'll say, okay, this one does go after the kids, right? So many of us weren't afraid because we said, well, it's only affecting a certain group of people, so we can keep those people safe and everybody else should be able to live their lives. Well, next time, if they want to unleash something like this, they would make sure that it is frightening, absolutely frightening and terrifying. Maybe it would have a physical symptom like smallpox, where you're really afraid of catching something like that. I just worry they're going to use this psychologically and all of the loopholes that they figured out legally, that next time it will be a lot harder to win this battle against them.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. And I will say this, that, you know, we have 50, Children's Health Defense has over 50 lawsuits right now, and a lot of them are addressing the mandates. And we've seen kind of a trend that you described, which at the beginning, no matter how clear the law was and how clearly right we were, the judges were just too frightened to, you know, to rule against the state dictates. And so we were getting really crazy decisions that just, you know, made no sense, but they, you know, they were clearly results oriented. And now we're getting more and more decisions that we win, but on rationales that will not give us, as you say, permanent protection. We are winning. I mean, the New York case that we won 2 weeks ago the judge did say this doesn't prevent transmission, therefore you can't have mandates. The mandates make no sense. So that, you know, was a good decision and a very, very good precedent. The case we won this week in California, which basically threw out the law, this new crazy California law that says that doctors aren't allowed to tell their patients about any of the bad side effects of vaccines, or, you know, and can't advise their patients in any way that disagrees with official government policies, and makes doctors essentially agents of state policy rather than, you know, healing physicians. And we did get that thrown out, but not on a you know, the rationale that the judge gave was not the rationale that you would want, which is, you know, this is a free speech, the First Amendment issue. And we didn't get that. We won, but we didn't win as big a victory as we wanted to. I would say this, that number one, any power that a government takes, it will never give back voluntarily. So now they have the power, make us lock down and put on masks, and they will say, okay, you don't have to do it anymore because this emergency is over, but they will retain that power so that they can impose it again. So we know that that is just a rule, you know, of essentially physics, that a government that takes power will never voluntarily relinquish that power. Another rule is that any power that a government takes, it will ultimately abuse to the maximum extent possible. And then the third rule that I would say people should keep in mind is that nobody ever complied their way out of totalitarian regime rules. So if you think that, you know, by obeying these rules that somehow things are going to get better, or it is going to satiate need to control you. It's not. It's just going to embolden them to do something worse the next time. The other thing that I think people should keep in mind is that people say to me, well, what, you know, will we get through this, et cetera? And I don't know because I know a lot about history, and I don't think we've ever been in this situation before. There have been many times when we lost democracy. There's been polarization that was this bad before, particularly during the Civil War, but other times in our history too, there have been really very, very toxic polarization. There's been times when we lost democracy and that large corporations, this particularly during the Gilded Age in the 1880s and 1890s, when corporations, particularly the big oil companies like Standard Oil, were running our country, and that we really did not have a functioning democracy. It was an illusion at that time. There was no direct election of senators. So senators were being picked by the legislatures. The legislatures were owned and moved around like pawns by Standard Oil. It was said of the Pennsylvania state legislature, they're not for sale because John D. Rockefeller owns them all and he won't sell any of them. And so you had, at that time, you had really democracy was over in our country, and yet it was restored. We came back during the early 1900s. We elected Teddy Roosevelt, who was a populist president. You had the populist movement in the countryside, the progressive movement in the cities. They united and elected Roosevelt. We started cutting away at this, monolith of corporate and government power, the merger of government and corporate power that had abolished democracy. So we established the 40-hour work week. We abolished child labor. We gave women the vote, women's suffrage for the first time. We made it illegal until 1908 for corporations to donate to federal political campaigns. We passed an income tax for the first time, a corporate income tax, as well, that made corporations and the wealthiest. I mean, John D. Rockefeller was richer than Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos combined. He's the richest man in history, and he owned the country. And we broke up Standard Oil. We passed the Sherman Antitrust Act. So it is possible, democracy has a resilience, and we were able to do that. But the question is, would you do that today? And that question, I don't think, has been answered. And the problem is that we've now got these instrumentalities, these technologies for control, for human behavioral control that we never had before. The ambition, the intention of every totalitarian regime in history is to control every aspect of human behavior, our speech, our thought, our transactions, our movements, everything that we do. But they've never been able to do that because, no government has ever had that reach. But today we have facial recognition systems all over the place. We have satellite systems. Bill Gates says his satellite system alone, which is 61,000 satellites, will be able to look low orbit satellites. Will be able to look at every square inch of the Earth 24 hours a day. We're now beginning on the road to adopting digital currencies, which will, which is economic slavery. As soon as that happens, we lose all rights because the government will be able to starve you. And we already have an example of that with the truckers' strike or demonstration in Toronto. Then Justin Trudeau sent people out to look at the license plates for these truckers, and then froze their bank accounts. So they couldn't pay their mortgage. They couldn't put their kids in school. They couldn't buy food for their family. None of them were charged with a crime. None of them were convicted of a crime. They weren't even charged. They were just, you were in the wrong place and therefore you're going to be punished. And so if they haven't declared another public emergency or pandemic, and there's a mask rule or a social distancing, and this week we all have to social distance, and the facial recognition and your GPS and your Apple Watch let them know that you got too close to your girlfriend, or that, you know, you didn't have a mask at a certain point, and they can just close down your bank account and say, okay, your credit cards will only work at grocery stores that are within a half mile radius of your house. And that kind of control can really diminish any inclination for dissent. Now, during the pandemic, I spoke at a demonstration in Germany where there were 1.3 million people. There were demonstrations again and again of millions of people in Australia and Austria, Germany and England, and we never heard about them in this country because the total control now of the press, the pharmaceutical and the intelligence agencies has made it so that they can hide the news from us. So the levels of control that they have now over human behavior are greater than we've ever seen. It's what I call a turnkey totalitarianism. And, you know, we don't know in the future. We're kind of in an arms race now where we're trying to educate the public and build our army to restore democracy. And they're racing at the same time to put this infrastructure in place that will give them total control to destroy dissent and to disable any kind of insurgency or subversion, and or any difference with the, you know, official government dead narratives and the orthodoxies. And so we don't know, you know, when they put that in place, it's really hard to predict whether democracy will have the resiliency to restore those institutions.
The good news, I mean, on the flip side of what I was just mentioning of how they could use this pandemic against us in a future pandemic if they wanted to, because now they know our psychology. On the flip side of that, there are a lot of people who went along, right? The ones that were not in that 30% who went along, who now in hindsight are starting to say, wait a minute, I fear took over me. I went the wrong way. And I was wrong about that. So maybe in the future, there will be more people who then say, I'm not gonna let the government have that kind of control over me again. That's a possibility, it's, you know, we can hope. But you know, along those lines, I mean, you mentioned, okay, it was Rockefeller who owned everything at one point. That's one person or one family. Now it seems to be tentacles everywhere. We've got like Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos. We have big money interests in the government. Government, you know, complete government takeover of the industry over the bodies that are supposed to be regulating them. I mean, we're seeing this happen everywhere. So what is our best bet, in your opinion, going forward to unravel that, to bring us back to democracy? Where do we even begin? What's the most important place? You know, where should we start? And then, you know, how do we get this back?
Well, the remedy ultimately for all of this is democracy, you know, and there, you know, I think our country has advantage over, for example, Europe, because we have the federal system where you have 50 little governments, and there a lot of those are kind of refuges for democracy today. There are governments out there that are passing legislation saying you can't do this with these mandates. You can't mandate vaccine. You can't mandate masks. You can't mandate lockdowns. And so the hope is that we'll be able to build institutions. You know, we'll be able to build alternative media to communicate with each other. And we're already doing those kind of things. And this, you know, this, what you do is one part of that. You know, this is an alternative network. Nothing like this existed prior to the pandemic. You know, you're building something here that is a new model for allowing dissent to blossom, to bloom, to seed, to grow. And, you know, we need to build all these whole new sets of institutions. We need to build new schools that, you know, that are actually protecting children's health and enriching children and their education. We need to build hospitals and clinics where the doctors are actually doing medicine rather than, you know, enforcing state policies. And we need to build these, you know, new communication systems that celebrate the truth, that allow debate, that allow these conversations. And My father always said that the democracy was completely dependent on the free flow of information. In fact, democracy has a lot of disadvantages because compared to totalitarian systems, totalitarian systems in the short term, at least, are much more efficient. You know, you have these top-down structures that are making orders and people implement them and do what they're told, and there's not debate and it's not messy and it happens very quickly, and Mussolini made the trains run on time, you know, for the first time in Italian history. And so totalitarian does have a lot of advantages. I mean, look at China. But, you know, over the long term, the efficiencies of democracy are understood to be greater. But the one advantage that democracy has over the short term is that the debate of policies allow the best ideas to triumph in the marketplace of debate, that become annealed in the furnace of debate, and then be implemented through the democratic system. And if you shut off debate, and if you shut off the free flow of information and start censoring things, we lose the one advantage that we have. And of course, once you start doing censorship, you are on the slippery slope to totalitarianism. And one of the things that I'd ask, you know, members of the press and people who are supporting censorship is, can you name any time in human history when, looking back, you believe that the censors were the good guys? You know, the censors are always pretty much the villains. And if you're advocating censorship today, the chances are that you're involved in some great villainy. Even if you believe that your intentions are correct, it's not. They aren't. Your intentions may be correct, but your actions are villainous.
Yeah. And I am seeing that censorship on both sides of the aisle. I know a lot of people point the finger at the other side, right? You've got Republicans pointing it at Democrats with everything that we've experienced during the pandemic. And then now you've got Democrats pointing at conservatives with them banning children's books or certain materials and whatnot. And everything is done in the, you know, from the guise of, well, this, but, you know, and I always hear that whenever I counter the censorship that happens in schools, and they say, but Kim, the children, you know, it's always, but Kim, there's, you know, I'm sure you're hearing that as well. There's always an excuse, and a person has it from the best, they're coming from the best of intentions, they're coming from a good place, they want to protect people. But at the end of the day, you're right, I think it's never the right answer. Looking at this pandemic, I kind of want to do an autopsy on it now that we're 3 years out of it. And you've written a couple of books about this pandemic, of course, about Anthony Fauci. Now you've got one coming out about the Wuhan lab. You've written The Letter to Liberals. You know, you've been really in the middle of this. Now that we're sort of coming out of it, I'm curious who you think or what you think was the most responsible for the worst of what happened. I mean, do you think it was Fauci or Bill Gates or China or the presidents, that, you know, Trump, Biden, Big Pharma, the WHO, the WEF? Like, where do you place the majority of your angst and blame for the pandemic response?
You know, I think that I think it's an institutional corruption. I think if you removed Anthony Fauci, he's going to be replaced by another Anthony Fauci. And we're living in the era that Dwight Eisenhower warned us against. So January 17th, 1960, when I was in Washington, D.C., 3 days later, I was at my uncle's inauguration. And in his farewell speech, Eisenhower gave probably the most important speech now, you know, in American history, where he warned Americans against the emergence of a military-industrial complex, where with the intelligence agencies, the Pentagon, and the associated industries, and he included the scientific bureaucracy. He specifically spent a lot of time in that speech talking about the federal scientific bureaucracy, meaning NIH, that they would be the authors of the destruction of American democracy if we allowed them to do that. And, you know, my uncle spent 3 years of his administration fighting against that force, against his military brass, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, He fired Alan Dulles, the head of the CIA, for lying to him about Cuba and the two other leaders, the CIA, and he stood up to his brass, refused to put combat troops in Laos, refused to put combat troops in Vietnam, and then he died. And then 5 years later, my father ran for president against the war machine, specifically against the Vietnam War, and he was killed in the midst of that campaign. And each time those deaths occurred, and when King's death, you know, King got killed after he spoke out against the war machine. You know, a lot of the civil rights movement did not want to get involved in the Vietnam War. And he said, you cannot ignore the connection between imperialism abroad and the colonialism and the national security state that's taking place, or the police state that's taking place back here. They're totally connected. And we cannot have an imperium abroad and have a democracy at home. We will turn America into a surveillance state and a national security state. And King was killed. And each of those deaths pushed us farther down that road to the military-industrial complex. And then 9/11, of course, you know, turned America really into the beginnings of a surveillance state. And then COVID completed the task. So if you look at who was at fault, somebody described to me yesterday, and they said, you know, blaming any individual is kind of fruitless, that there's been a trench dug, and all the water now will flow into that trench. And so all of the ambitions of those, you know, once you create a crisis, Naomi Klein wrote this about disaster capitalism. Once there's a crisis, there are groups that are built, that are constructed to capitalize on that crisis. And some of those groups may be creating crises so that they can get the payoff. You know, and that's what I think we're all worried about, the gain of function study. You talk about a pathogen that can kill children or create sort of hideous contagion. Well, guess what? We are financing the creation of those very things in labs, not only in China, but in the Ukraine, 46 labs in the Ukraine, and at the University of North Carolina and the University of Texas, Galveston, and, you know, in labs all over this country are making those creatures right now. And there's two escapes a week from those labs in the United States alone. So, you know, all they have to do is keep making them, and they know one of them is going to escape, even if they don't deliberately release it. They know it's going to escape. And so, and yeah, and every time it escapes, they get richer, the pharma gets richer, the CIA gets more powerful, the military-industrial complex gets more powerful, and American democracy shrinks. And so I wouldn't point to a single person. I'd point to a system that we need to fight, which is the onset of the military-industrial complex, which now owns the press. And, you know, the Ukraine war is just a series of oil wars that, you know, we have one after the other. And I'm not going to say it's right or wrong. I'm going to say we ought to be debating it. We ought to be able to talk about it. Just like we should have been able to talk about the Iraq war, but they can't, they quiet all the dissent. So that, you know, yes, of course, America has to get into a new war every 5 years. And the job of the CIA is to develop a pipeline of new wars that America can fight to feed this, you know, this machine in the, you know, military contractors. And look what happened in COVID. There were 138 companies that were involved in manufacturing and distributing the vaccine. They're all military contractors. The Pentagon and the National Security Agency ran the entire pandemic response. Pfizer and Moderna don't really own those vaccines. You know, they slapped their labels on them, but it was a Pentagon project. And so, you know, we're dealing with a military-industrial complex, and Americans now need to take our democracy back from them.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus right now, obviously, on international relations, war. You know, we've got, of course, the conflict with the proxy war going on right now with Russia. they're escalating and they're talking a lot about, I mean, they're really snarling now at China. They've announced more bases in the Philippines and embassies in the Solomon Islands, and needing, you know, NATO head saying we got to make more friends in the Indo-Pacific region and whatnot. And so, you know, a lot of people are really worried about China. A lot of people are really worried about Russia. In your opinion, what is the greatest threat we're facing right now as a nation? Is it these external forces, or some people believe it's racism. We've heard that for the last couple of years coming from liberals. Sexualization of kids, that's what the right is really talking about a lot right now. What do you think, you know, now we've made all of these strange political bedfellows, we've got all these new political allies, we can either harness this new alliance that we've built, or we could just allow it to erode in these kind of culture and different sort of political viewpoints, or we can get together and really truly try to make some true change with these alliances that we found. I mean, where do you think we should be focusing our energy and our effort politically?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, if generally speaking, what I would say is that in foreign policy, that America should have a powerful enough army that we should be a fortress at home.
Right.
And that we should not be the policeman for the world. We shouldn't have 822 bases in every country in the world. And that, you know, just guarantee that we're in a state of permanent war. Our John Quincy Adams, that America salutes and supports democracy across the broad, across the world, but we do not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Because if we start, they all understood you cannot have a democracy at home and have an imperial nation abroad. And if you look what's happened, the cost of maintaining all those bases and fighting these wars, the Iraq war costs us $8.2 trillion. The Iraq and its aftermath, which is Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Pakistan, et cetera. And that is hollowed out the middle class. We're now sending ultimately $100 billion to the Ukraine. Oh, you know, there's a whole generation of American children. My wife did not pay back her college loans until she was 37 years old. You know, and we have a whole nation of children. Education used to be free in this country. That's what created this middle class after World War II, the biggest middle class in history, the biggest economic expansion in history, what they call the Great Prosperity. And it was because we created the GI Bill and we gave everybody, the millions of people who had participated in World War II, we gave them all free education, and they then created prosperity for us. Well, now, any kid who goes through college is, for the rest of their life, they're paying back, they've got this hanging over their head. We have hollowed out the middle class in our country. And the promise was, okay, when we beat the Russians, you're going to get a peace dividend, and we no longer will spend $1 billion on a bomber, on a stealth bomber that can't fly in the rain. Instead, we're going to take that money, and we're going to build schools, and we're going to build highways, and we're going to build sewage treatment plants, and we're going to have a clean environment. We're going to clean up our water so people can fish and hunt, and we're going to... we're going to enrich the lives of the typical American by creating infrastructure that makes their lives better. And we never did that. It's a broken promise. And instead, this money is just going to the military contractors. And when we give $100 billion to the Ukraine, where's that money going? It's going to the Ukraine, and then it's bouncing back. It doesn't even leave the United States. It goes right to General Dynamics, and it goes right to Boeing and to all the military contractors and hardware companies. And they and then they sell their weapon systems over there. And then they have, you know, their consultants and their board of directors are all these former generals who now show up on CNN without their conflicts ever being identified, telling the Americans how we need to be in the Ukraine. And so it's all this kind of propaganda effort where the media is just a propaganda vessel for the military industrial complex and for the pharmaceutical industry, which is, you know, financing, you know, the evening news. You look on the evening news and, you know, Anderson Cooper's brought to you by Pfizer. He's not working for the American people and he's not working for CNN. He's working for Pfizer. His job is to scare the heck out of you so that you want to get vaccinated and then to push vaccines as safe and effective. He lied for 2 years, killed hundreds of thousands of Americans by getting people not to take things that actually worked, ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, because they're off-patent drugs that, you know, that make no money for his sponsors. And, you know, and so you have the media that is captive of the intelligence agencies and the pharmaceutical companies, and they are propagandizing us into policies that will sell pharmaceutical products and that will keep us in a constant state of war. And Americans need to understand that they are being lied to, they are being tricked, and that, you know, that money, where do you think inflation comes from? Inflation comes from, they had to print $16 trillion to pay for the lockdowns. And they have to print $100 billion to support the Ukraine. We don't have that money. So they printed it. And then the poor people in the middle class pay for it through taxes. Inflation is a tax on the poor. That's what it is. So when you see, you know, when you're paying $7 a gallon at the tank, and when you're paying, you know, twice as much for eggs and twice as much for milk as you were last year, you're paying for, you know, that Ukraine. So you can still say, well, I want to support the Ukraine, but you should know you are paying for it. And it's coming from you. It's coming from your children. And your child pays his college loans for the next 30 years rather than having the government pay them off, you know, today. You should say, okay, that was worth it because we were, you know, fighting for the Ukraine. Oh, you know, people need to understand that, and that needs to be discussed on TV, and we need to know, we need to be able to talk about what we want, what kind of country we want, and what we want this country to look like.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Robert. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., founder, chairman, and chief litigation counsel for Children's Health Defense, and just really been fighting for us these last few years and really longer. I mean, a lot of us just now began to follow you because of the pandemic. But if you go back and look at all of the work you've done throughout your entire career, I mean, you really have been a true fighter for the people, even when you're smeared. I mean, you've been called all kinds of names, demonized, and I just really admirable, you know, you should be very proud of your life's work. I would say you've done a really fantastic, you know, thing for fighting for us for a long, long time. Environment, children, now this, and I'm sure more to come, unfortunately. Yeah, I wish there wasn't more to fight for, but unfortunately, I think in the future there will be more that you're going to have to do for us. So thank you again for this discussion, and thank you for everything you've done.
And thank you, Kim, for your courage and for your integrity and for reminding us about what journalists are supposed to be doing. It's really, you know, one of the weird things, I'll say this, I know we're done, but if you look at, you know, if I think about all the journalists who have, you know, who have been part of this propaganda effort, and including smearing me and all of that, which I don't care about, but most of them started out, they went to journalism school because they were idealistic about what they were going to do with their lives, and they thought that they were going to be part of the guardianship of democracy, and, you know, and promoting debate and searching for existential truths and then revealing them to the public. And they have now, you know, virtually every journalist in this country working for the mainstream media is now just a propaganda shill, a tool for big pharma and for the military industrial complex. That's what they do. You know, they don't do journalism. They do propaganda and, you know, and stenography. And journalists are supposed to, you know, American journalism in a democracy The job of a journalist is to maintain a posture of fierce skepticism and antagonism toward government and government officials, to disbelieve everything they say and make them explain it. That, unfortunately, that is the job of a journalist, and to speak truth to power. And they don't do that. Now they have become the bullhorn for the powerful, rushing and demonizing, as you say, dissent, and, you know, vilifying anybody who actually tries to tell the truth. Well, thank you for being an exemplar, a template, a role model for what journalists are supposed to be doing.
Thank you. Well, we were just chatting with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Very fascinating interview there. You know, he is the founder of Children's Health Defense, which is a great organization that really has been fighting for children and people in general for a really long time. And he's written 3 books. Do you want to showcase those for you? The Real Anthony Fauci. I have that on my bookshelf, and I have to tell you guys, it is filled with information. And I mean, when I got the book, I bought it online. It was shipped to me. And when I got that Real Anthony Fauci book, it was, I mean, it is, if they didn't shrink the print and fill in all the margins, that thing would be 1,000 pages. So he's just written a detailed expose on Fauci. He's also got a letter to liberals, censorship, COVID, an attack on science and American ideals. I don't know how many liberals are actually going to read that and actually take it to heart. But, you know, we can hope that many will. And also the Wuhan cover-up, which is coming out, which I know many of us are really interested in reading. So what a wonderful interview with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And we'll be doing more of these interviews on Fridays. You can look forward to that here on The Kim Iverson Show.